From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Feminist and social critic Ellen Willis helped show a generation of women that there were choices other than the traditional ones of wife and mother. But now Willis herself is a mother, trying to balance personal freedom against family responsibilities. Willis talks about trying to find the right balance on this edition of Fresh Air. Also, David Levitt tells us about writing fiction about the family from a gay perspective. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Charlie Rich, a musician who started out playing Stan Kenton's jazz and ended up as one of country music's biggest stars. And book critic John Leonard reviews Salman Rushdie's controversial new novel, Satanic Verses. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Ellen Willis is a feminist and social critic who has described herself as obsessed with the idea of freedom. She's written on subjects as diverse as rock and roll, politics, sex, religion, pornography, and the family. She was once described as a natural dissident who is always taking unpopular positions. For instance, she's even criticized certain segments of the feminist movement, such as the anti-pornography groups, which she describes as moralistic. Willis is a former rock critic for The New Yorker magazine, and since the 70s has written for The Village Voice, where she's now a senior editor. In her personal life and in her writing, Willis has explored alternatives to the nuclear family. She once wrote, "I was put off by the marriages I observed. Domestic life, as most of my peers lived it, made me feel claustrophobic. What disturbed me was the degree of emotional repression that most, quote, successful marriages seem to involve." But at the age of 42, Willis started a family of her own. She lives with her daughter, Nona, who is now 4.5 years old, and with Nona's father. I asked Ellen Willis why she decided to take the plunge and create a family, since she had been so committed to living as independently and with as few constraints as possible.
I think the problem is that it's like I never wanted to have a family in the institutional sense of the word. I mean, I wanted to have a lover. And at a certain point, I wanted to have a child. And, you know, wanting to have a child probably for the same complex of reasons, quote, good reasons and neurotic reasons, you know, that everybody wants to have a child, from being able to, from having, you know, first of all, a purely erotic, you know, desire to have a child, you know, that soft little baby in your arms, it's like creating a new love relationship. So I think I never quite articulated that to myself till after she was born, to, you know, wanting to help a new being develop and you know, sort of have somebody with which to kind of transmit your heritage and everything you've learned to the sort of darker aspects of, you know, on some level, probably wanting a little clone of myself, you know, because I really did want a girl. But it's like all those reasons, you know, really sort of have nothing to do in a way with the institution of family. Well, they, I mean, they probably do on some deep psychological level, but, and so it was sort of never a choice of, let's go out and make myself a family. It was, you know, if I was going to have a lover and we were going to live together, you know, and then we were going to have a child, sort of that kind of created a nuclear family, and which I've never really been happy with that. I would much prefer like a much less isolated kind of situation.
Can you share with us what some of your fears of the nuclear family have been? You know, about having one yourself?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's like a very isolating way to live. Now, Nona's father and I share parenthood, and that's certainly better than doing it yourself. But at the same time, what it means basically is that two people are exhausted all the time instead of one person being exhausted. Nona doesn't have any siblings. You know, I think, like, to try to be a writer, you know, with two people who are trying to do their other work and raise children, like, really becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to envision, you know, having more than one or at the most two children. So Nona has to find her community in daycare, and, you know, like, we have a very good cooperative parent-run childcare situation. But, you know, the point is, it's like very isolating and kind of anti-community, the nuclear family. It's like very hard to find time to be with other people, you know, in more than a superficial social life kind of way.
Now, we should say that the father of your daughter is not your husband. You've decided to not get married. And it's an interesting decision to make. I think a lot of people who live together and don't get married end up getting married if they decide to have children. You've had a daughter, she's 4 and a half, and yet you've still maintained your decision to not get married. How come?
Well, for one thing, I think because we were so pissed off at all the social pressure to get married that, you know, it was just, you know, we weren't going to give into it. And then I think it's a sort of a symbolic thing. You know, it's kind of a symbolic way of, like, keeping a sense of cultural radicalism alive, although I think it's very symbolic because I think on a practical level, you're married. Whether you're married or not, when you have a kid in that kind of household, you're married. But I also feel like I had a lot of illusions that somehow, you know, unconscious illusions that somehow by not getting married, I would like protect myself from a lot of the problems that marriage and the nuclear family situation inevitably lead to, you know, such as the feeling that you can't get out of this. I mean, the feeling that you want to have that your love affair is a spontaneous thing and you're there absolutely because you want to be there and not because your life is such that it would be like really hard to get out of it if you didn't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that kind of thing and the way routine, you know, was sort of so inimical to passion. And, you know, in some way I felt like not getting married would like protect us against that, you know, but of course it doesn't, and it's like a big struggle, you know, whether you're married or not.
Feminist social critic Ellen Willis is my guest. You became a mother during what you've described as the worst orgy of cultural sentimentality about babies and family since the 60s. And it's an interesting observation. How do you think this cultural orgy of sentimentality about babies and the family has been expressed in the past few years? What are some examples?
Well, I think, you know, that kind of everywhere in popular culture, pregnancy and parenthood, but particularly motherhood, are glorified. And being, not having children, you know, or being alone, I mean, it's still sort of more respectable than it was before the 60s, but there's like been a resurgence of, I think, a great resentment against childless people that they're somehow, they're selfish, they're narcissistic, they're like getting away with something. You know, they're not putting their noses to the grindstone. And also where the sentimentality comes in is then that resentment is sort of turned into pity. Well, you're really missing the greatest experiences life has to offer, you know, and so forth.
Did any of that ever get to you, though, even though you really see it as phony sentimentality?
Yeah, I think probably. I mean, it's like, how can it not?
Uh-huh. I always wonder if, you know, a lot of people of the baby boom generation waited so long to have children, if that led to a more self-dramatizing posture about becoming parents.
Yeah, inevitably it does, because I think for one thing, people who are like very ambivalent, you know, when you finally decide to come down on one side of the ambivalence, there's sort of an enormous need, I think, in a lot of people to kind of drown out the other side. you know, I mean, I think that I was always very ambivalent about having a child. I never quite gave up the idea. At the same time, you know, I was never quite ready to do it, you know, until I was sort of confronted with the fact that, you know, I'd like really better make a decision about this. And I think I'm very glad I did it, but I feel like all the reasons that I didn't want to do it are still true.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
It's just a much harder life, and I feel like in terms of my work and in terms of having time for myself, to develop myself, you know, which I don't think is narcissistic, but a basic human need. And you know, in terms of my sexual and emotional and intellectual life. I mean, it's like very difficult in this kind of a society to pay the kind of attention that you need to your child and to being a parent and having a child and to pay attention to all these other things. You know, I don't think that this is sort of like inherent in the nature of having a child. I think it's in the nature of how our society is organized.
You recently had an interesting piece in the Village Voice about how in the 60s you were really one of the people who were pushing things to the limit, both sexually, with drugs, with food, with music.
Especially food.
And now you find yourself as a parent as being the person who's setting the limits and who's doing the things that you might have at one time thought of as very repressive. Has that been a big crisis for you, to see yourself in this new role?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a crisis. I think it's an irony. And it's like in the piece, I was trying to distinguish how I felt about this from the conservative idea that, you know, basically the process of child-rearing is, you know, to take this person with, like, limitless desires and kind of, like, mold them into a civilized being. I think it's almost sort of the opposite that, you know, I think basically I'm for, I mean, I think the children can be like basically self-regulating and are like much more capable than we give them credit for of being able to set their own limits on things and know what's good for them and know what's bad for them. But that the ways in which we've all grown up, you know, including the way I was brought up, that we ourselves are like so neurotic about, you know, we were not brought up in a self-regulated way. And we're sort of so neurotic about the limits which were set for us and our ambivalence about them and are not, you know, that we transmit that to our children. And, you know, that once you do that, then you have to set limits because you've sort of disrupted the children's ability to do it. So that there's almost like a tragic thing, you know, that goes on from parent to child, and that's sort of what I was trying to convey in that piece.
Mm-hmm. You and what do you call Stanley, who's the father of your daughter, a lover? Or, I mean, do you have a word you like to use?
Well, I think there's sort of no good word for it.
And if you use the word lover, people think that it's like purely sexual. If you use the word significant other, it's a kind of trendy, cold phrase to use.
And partner sounds like a business.
Right.
You know, which a lot of the time when you're kind of administrating a household is...
it's like, kind of true, right?
Yeah.
Spouse equivalent.
Right. The father of my child.
Right.
My friend, companion, lover, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyways, you and he are both cultural and political radicals, I think that's fair to say. Yes?
Yes.
And so you're really basically in agreement about... you know, the theoretical ways in which one should go about living one's life. But when it comes down to it and you're sharing a household together and it comes time to do the dishes or vacuum the floor or decide who's going to drive your daughter to the daycare center, I don't know how much the politics really come into play because these are like hard daily decisions that have to be made. And I'm wondering if in your house you still go through the same kind of problems and quarrels and discussions that most of us have about dealing with these kinds of things.
Well, I mean, you know, we have definitely the ideology that we should share everything. And at the same time, you're sort of dealing with a situation of scarcity where, like, every, you know, like, especially when Nona was younger, you know, this is getting to be less true, but certainly when she was a baby, when, you know, sort of time is so scarce that you're just both, like, desperate for just, like, a minute of rest or a minute of time for yourself. And, you know, I think that would lead to a lot of struggles, even if it weren't for, you know, sort of all sorts of sexist kinds of dynamics that inevitably come into play. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I think we both pretty much do our best in good faith to try to share everything.
So do you have a system for doing it?
Not really. I mean, it's, you know, part of the problem you come into is that there's so much time spent in administration that the idea of like sort of sitting down and preparing a list of things to do for the week is just like one extra task that you can't stand, you know, even though it doesn't really save time not to do it because then you end up having fights about, you know, who should do this or that or who last did this or that or, you know, whose turn it is to do this or that. But I think, you know, by this time we've sort of established a pretty good working division of labor about mm-hmm. most things. But then there always are things, you know, like I really have a driving phobia. I have a driver's license, but I hate driving. And, you know, it's sort of like definitely, I know, connected with all sorts of things about femaleness. And so Stanley does like most of the driving. I mean, virtually all the driving when we're like in the city together. And, you know, Nona has been seeing this, and I've sort of been very bugged by the fact that she's been seeing this. And, you know, at one point she even said to me, "You have to have a penis to drive, right, Mom?"
Oh, so, I'm sure this is exactly what you wanted to hear.
You know, and I feel like this is really on my agenda as a big thing that I have to deal with. But in the meantime, I'm sort of, you know, she's now like seeing like a lot of other parents and a lot of other women who drive. And, you know, I've sort of tried to make her understand that this is my weirdness and not, you know, not that women can drive. And now she sort of sits in the driver's seat and she pretends that she's driving and she really wants to learn to drive. So, you know, sort of the most important thing is that, you know, she should get the idea that this is great, you know, for her to try to do and, you know, right. So on.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is feminist and social critic Ellen Willis, who is a senior editor for The Village Voice. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Feminist and social critic Ellen Willis is my guest, and she's now beginning a new book on feminism, sex, and the family. I wonder if becoming a mother has changed your priorities in terms of what you think the feminist agenda should be.
I don't think it's sort of changed my priorities so much in the intellectual sense as, you know, it's obviously made me more aware, more practically, you know, concretely, like immediately concerned with certain kinds of things. You know, particularly, you know, issues of childcare and child rearing. And it's like I'm very concerned now because I feel like there's a big push for childcare because there are so many women in the workforce, but that since there isn't really a strong feminist movement that's, you know, talking about really feminist-oriented issues about childcare and child-rearing, you know, I'm really afraid that, you know, what we're going to end up with is just sort of childcare that's really designed to help women do their two jobs as efficiently as possible, and, you know, instead of, you know, what we really need, which is sort of a whole reorientation of our idea of what child-rearing is and that it's not simply the mother's job, but, you know, that it's men's and women's jobs together, but also not only the parents' job, but really a public concern. So, yeah, I think it's certainly sort of made me think more practically, you know, sort of more deeply about these things in a practical sense rather than a kind of very theoretical sense.
What surprised you the most about becoming a mother? And I'm thinking here that a lot of women I know expected to, like, go right back to work just a few weeks or a couple of months after the baby was born, but ended up staying home and caring for their child a lot longer than they had initially thought that they would because they wanted to.
Well, I think it was a surprise to me, in a sense, like, how much fun it was. How much pleasure it was. And, you know, I feel like I'd read about certain things, but, you know, it's sort of you never quite realize it until it hits you. But there's like this enormous schizophrenia when the child is an infant. And, you know, on the one hand, you're like utterly and like completely exhausted all the time. And it, you know, completely takes over your life. And at the same time, it's like so much fun. And it's like, very hard, you know, it's sort of like very hard to realize that it could be like really both those things at the same time. At the same time, it took me like about 4 months, 3 or 4 months to be ready to go back to work. But by then I really was ready to start having an outside life again. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't stop. You know, I wanted that. You know, even though I was really having fun with the baby, you know, it was like being home all day would be too much of a good thing.
Mm-hmm. The book that you're starting to write now is on feminism, sex, and the family. And the subject makes me think about how, in really a lot of your writing, sexual freedom has been a very important issue, and that women should be able to enjoy sex as well as men, if you know what I mean. That a lot of people have defined sexual desire as more of a male than a female interest.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm curious about how that aspect of sexuality became so important to your kind of feminist analysis.
I think because when I was growing up, I had so much. I mean, I basically had a conservative upbringing about sex, and you know, basically, throughout my adolescence, was in like an enormous conflict about sex, and I was like very angry, you know, just sort of very angry and resentful about the double standard about sex, and about how long it took me to be able to get to the point, you know, sort of where I could really feel clear about my right to have sex and be able to enjoy sex without feeling, you know, without feeling that it was illegitimate or without feeling that men kind of had the right to judge me, you know, according to the double standard of morality. And, you know, this, you know, just made a huge impression on me, and you know, was sort of like one of the most important things that led to having a feminist consciousness. You know, the other thing was housework, because I was very determined from an early age that, you know, I was, you know, for some reason, I, you know, thought it was very unfair that my mother did all the housework. I don't know. I got that consciousness very early, and I was like not going to do the same thing. And I was, you know, very conscious that this was a great injustice. But the other thing was sex.
Well, you came of age during the sexual revolution, quote, in the 60s. And now that a lot of people are almost afraid to have sex because of sexually transmitted diseases, I wonder if you've been rethinking at all the sexual revolution.
Well, you know, first I think that there's only ever like really been the beginnings of a sexual revolution. You know, like I said in my article, you know, it's early feminists looking at the sexual revolution. We had the same reaction to it that, you know, Gandhi, when asked what did he think of Western civilization, said, "I think it would be a good idea." And, you know, we sort of felt the same way about the sexual revolution, you know, like great idea, but it's really hardly gotten off the ground. That, you know, I think you have to have an affirmation of sex as a good thing, as a need, you know, a physical and emotional need, and as a source of ecstasy and transcendence that's, you know, an extremely important thing to the well-being of people, and that remains true no matter how risky it may be. You know, I think one has to deal with the risks. One had to deal with the risks of pregnancy, you know, one has to deal with the risks of disease, but that, you know, basically one has to affirm sex as a good thing, you know, which is something our culture hasn't yet been able to do, you know, even in spite of, I mean, I feel like we just began to do it with the sexual revolution. You know, I think a sexual revolution also entails, you know, genuinely accepting that women have equal sexual needs and equal sexual rights to men, you know, which is still not really accepted. You know, I think a symptom of that is that abortion, you know, still isn't really accepted. And, you know, then I think a real sexual revolution, you know, sort of has to deal with all the dynamics of kind of the deeply anti-sexual and puritanical anti-pleasure upbringing that everybody has. And, you know, I think this process has to go on, and dealing with, you know, things like disease and unwanted pregnancy are practical problems. you know, which we have to undertake, but which could be undertaken in a much more rational way, were we to start from the premise that what we want to do, that our ideal is to, is that everyone should have as much sexual joy in their life as is possible. You know, then you say, how can we deal with AIDS, you know, whatever, in such a manner as, you know, not only to have people survive, you know, and not get sick and not die, but to help them have good sexual lives.
You co-founded a couple of the very early women's consciousness-raising groups in 1968 and 1969 in New York. And I'd be really curious what some of the main issues were at those early meetings and how that compares to what you see as the main issues now.
Well, I think the paramount issue then was just getting into public consciousness that there really was a problem called male supremacy or male, you know, male domination of women, that women were oppressed, and that our kind of main project was like analyzing and again making public like all the different ways in which women were considered as secondary human beings. I mean, a lot of things that are just sort of second nature now and kind of in the air now simply weren't. I mean, there was sort of a reflexive, taken-for-granted sexism then, you know, that sort of doesn't really exist now. I mean, people thought you were crazy if you said, well, I don't like walking down the street and being hassled by men. What do you mean? They're being appreciative. You know, what are you talking about? I don't, you know, again, things like the sexual double standard, things like men should share the housework, you know, which granted the idea is now honored more in The Breach, that, you know, then it wasn't even, you know, you were really looked on as a nut if you went to a dinner party and said, why are all the women clearing the table and the men aren't doing it? So a lot of our agenda was confronting men on these things, you know, like both on personal lives and also in on a public level, and, you know, doing the same thing with other women, you know, hey, we shouldn't be putting up with this. And this was really what consciousness raising was about. You know, then there was the whole level of public consciousness raising. There was like more writing that was being done in those early days of the women's movement than, you know, I can remember from any political movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first public policy issue that I think really emerged as a priority was abortion.
I guess that brings us to today, because that's still an issue.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think it's crucially important now that somehow we have to be able to get off the defensive and, you know, mount an offensive, you know, aimed at keeping and at extending abortion rights, because, in fact, there's been a lot of erosion since 1973, you know, particularly about questions of public funding.
Ellen Willis, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for sharing some of your time with us. My guest has been Ellen Willis, and she's a senior editor at The Village Voice and is working on a new book on feminism, sex, and the family. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with film director Joe Dante. He began his career making trailers for Roger Corman's New World Pictures and went on to direct one of Corman's biggest hits, Piranha. Dante's films include The Howling, Gremlins, Inner Space, and his new film, The Burbs, which stars Tom Hanks. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Levitt has written a new novel in which the main character is gay and his sister is a lesbian feminist. Their mother has adopted an attitude of hopeful resignation about her children's sexual preferences. Coming up, David Levitt talks about writing fiction about the family from a gay perspective. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks at the career of Charlie Rich. If you know Rich only as a country singer, Ed thinks you'll be surprised at how versatile a musician he really is. And book critic John Leonard reviews Satanic Verses. Salman Rushdie's novel has outraged Muslims and resulted in a death sentence from the Ayatollah Khomeini because of its portrayal of the Prophet Muhammad. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. The judge in the Iran-Contra case today rejected a key element in the newly proposed additional safeguards for national security documents in the Oliver North trial. This means that the issue now rests with the Supreme Court, which is scheduled to take it up on Friday. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Federal Judge Gerhard Gesell glowered from the bench and said it was time for a ruling. If he accepted the deal worked out between the special prosecutor and the Bush administration over the weekend, the Supreme Court would lift its stay and the trial would proceed. But Gesell said he was not taking that out. While he accepted most of the procedures agreed to over the weekend, one element, he said from the bench, is unacceptable. It is unacceptable, he said, to allow the Attorney General, at whatever point he wishes during the trial, to rush into court with an affidavit that could result in the dismissal of some or all charges. If the Bush administration has objections to certain information coming out at the trial, said the judge, it should bite the bullet now, in advance of the jury being sworn. Holding the Attorney General's feet to the fire, the judge said, if a case reaches the situation where the national security is threatened, the attorney may scuttle the case, but he must do it now. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
Secretary of State James Baker is selling stocks from his portfolio that have raised controversy. Chief among these is his holding in New York's Chemical Bank. It has a lot of money loaned out to the Third World, and Third World debt crisis is one of the most pressing issues in international relations today. The leaders of five Central American nations today agreed to draft a detailed plan to remove the Nicaraguan Contra rebels from Honduras. In addition, the Nicaraguan government promised to move up presidential and legislative elections by 10 months and have UN observers present during the elections. The agreement comes out of a summit meeting held over the last 2 days in El Salvador. Victims of the Bhopal gas leak say they're outraged by the $470 million settlement agreed to today by Union Carbide. The 1984 disaster is the worst industrial accident in history. 2,000 people died immediately. More than 1,300 others died later from exposure to the deadly methyl isocyanate gas. More than 20,000 people still suffer from exposure to the gas, and victims continue to die at the rate of at least one a day. Union Carbide officials today call the $470 million settlement fair. The Air Force is investigating allegations of shoddy construction at a $500 million radar site in central Oregon. More from Jim Follansbee of member station KSOR.
General Electric, the project's prime contractor, and the Air Force has confirmed reports of poor construction at its over-the-horizon backscatter radar installation in the Oregon desert. The problems include upside-down steel bars, cracked mounts on the radar towers, missing bolts, and a bent antenna. Workers at the site noticed the problems and tried to tell the subcontractor which is building the towers. But Robert Lay, a construction worker on the project, says he was told by supervisors, quote, to just keep it quiet. Lay notified General Electric of the problem last month, and the company began an immediate investigation. Oregon Senator Mark Hatfield's office is also investigating. The Air Force manager of the backscatter program says all the problems are correctable, but he would not estimate the cost of fixing them. For National Public Radio, this is Joe Follansbee in Ashland, Oregon.
There was a successful rocket launch today from Cape Canaveral as a new Air Force Delta II rocket carried a navigation satellite into orbit. Work on the Delta II began after the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, and the successful launch today gives the military space program a new and presumably reliable way to get equipment into orbit. Stock prices ended mixed in moderate trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just over a point to close at 2281.25. Advances slightly outnumbered declines on a volume of 150 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 5 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of Charlie Rich, a singer-songwriter with a distinctive voice, a predilection for jazz, and a career that fell between the cracks, but not before he made several hit records.
Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? And if you did, was she crying, crying? Hey.
Is this what you think of when you hear Charlie Rich's name? Probably. For a while there in the 70s, he had a decent career as a country star, one of the bright lights in Billy Sherrill's stable of countrypolitan performers, and recorded songs that range from excellent to awfully sentimental. It did, however, make him a lot of money, and those of us who'd been following Charlie Rich's career for a while were certainly glad to see that happen. Charlie Rich was born in 1932 in the Arkansas hamlet of Colt, not far from Memphis, and almost from the very beginning, he was different. He became a jazz buff in high school and loved Stan Kenton's music so much the kids called him Charlie Kenton. He picked out odd chords and strange voicings on the family piano and wound up playing a lot of jazz when he went off to college. He joined the Air Force, married his old high school sweetheart, Margaret Ann, and played music on weekends while he worked a chicken farm during the week. In 1959, he decided to give recording a shot and went to the most natural place in Memphis, Sun Records.
Make it all right.
We'll make it all right.
From Monday morning to Friday night.
Oh, those lonely weekends.
Since you left me.
Since you left me.
I'm as lonely as I can be.
Oh, those lonely weekends.
Said you'd be.
Lonely Weekends, despite the horrible backup vocals, was a substantial hit in 1960, but it took him a while to get it released. He spent the first part of his time at Sun writing songs for Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison, and finally got to make his own record almost as an afterthought. It came at a time when Sam Phillips was losing interest in the label he'd started a decade earlier, and although he later said that he felt that only Elvis exceeded the raw talent he'd seen in Charlie Rich, it was only because the record was as good as it was that it got heard at all. It got virtually no promotion, and the label was in its last months when it was released. Still, Charlie was in a good position. He'd had a hit, and he was talented and a fairly fresh face. The next stop was Smash, a Nashville-based division of Mercury, and Smash was just what he had.
Who is the hippie that's happening all over our town? Tearing up the chicks with the message that he lays down. Who is the coolest guy that is what I am?
Mohair Sam was the college girl's dream, hip and happening, and the song made it to the top 40 in 1965. But Charlie, prematurely gray and 33 years old, was nobody's idea of a teen idol, or even a college kid's idol. Nobody seemed to know what to do with him, and after no follow-up was forthcoming, Smash let him go. He showed up next at High Records in Memphis, where they had him cut an album of Hank Williams material and some soul-flavored stuff that they never even bothered to release. Soon, they too cut him loose. Chet Atkins had just been put in charge of a hip new label at RCA called Groove, and he figured that Charlie was just what they needed, so he signed him and set him onto a magnificent version of a Jimmy Reed song.
Big boss man, won't you hear me when I call?
Big boss man.
Yeah, big boss man, won't you hear me when I call? Just holding us all.
Big Boss Man was prime Charlie Rich, soulful and bluesy, and it's now considered a classic, but it only made tiny waves in 1967 when it was released. Next, they too tried him on country material, but nobody wanted to know about it. the string of failures had taken its toll. Back at Sun, he'd cut a tune called Sittin' and Thinkin', and it told the story of the next few years.
I got loaded last night on a bottle of gin. And I had a fight with my best girlfriend. But when I'm drinking, I am nobody's friend. But please, baby, wait for me until they let me out again.
In the song, he admits it'll happen again, and it has. Despite his finally finding success in 1973 with Behind Closed Doors, Charlie Rich's demons have won out time after time. In his fine books Feel Like Going Home and Lost Highway, Peter Guralnick has two superb portraits of Rich before and after success, with both Charlie and Margaret Ann being unflinchingly honest about his alcohol problem and his problems with people who want to straitjacket him into playing one type of music or another. It's never been easy to be an original in American popular music, but if you can find some of those old Charlie Rich records, I guarantee you some moments quite unlike anything else you've ever heard.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
I see your great big sign on a one-way street, going down the wrong way. Who do I meet? A big policeman walking his beat. Everything I do is wrong. Yeah, now everything I do.
This is Fresh Air. Writer David Levitt says his first book, Family Dancing, was considered unusual because he was writing short stories about gays and lesbians in the context of families. Levitt says no one had really done that before, that most fiction about gay people was set in the gay world, the so-called gay ghetto. Family Dancing won accolades not only for its subject matter, but also for the quality of the writing. Many critics were surprised to learn that the writer was only 23. Now, 5 years later, Levitt has maintained his position as one of the finer young writers. His new book, his third, is a novel called Equal Affections. It's again the story of a family, one in which the son is gay, the daughter is a lesbian feminist, and their mother is dying of cancer. I asked Levitt why he's so interested in families.
The experience of being in a family is such a universal one, and even for people who don't grow up in families, the absence of a family becomes the sort of formative factor in their growing up. And most literature, it seems to me, either has to do with the life of families or with sort of running away from families, or at least most of the literature I like best.
You once wrote in an essay that home may be the most dangerous place of all, but it's also the only chance we have. What were some of the dangers you were referring to?
Well, the dangers which always crop up as a result of intimacy. I mean, I suppose one thing which I find myself continually reaffirming in my writing is that love without intimacy can't exist. And while it's true that intimacy is dangerous in that to be close to someone means risking the tragedy of losing that person or risking the tragedy of having a kind of explosive emotional relationship which causes pain, on the other hand, there really is no alternative.
Let's talk about the family that you've created for your new book. The main character, Danny, is gay and he's a lawyer, and his sister April is 9 years older than he is. She's a lesbian feminist and a singer and songwriter and very popular in the women's music circuit. I think some people will see it as slightly unbelievable that two siblings should be gay, but I know examples where it's happened. I think it's really not that unusual.
No, it's not unusual at all. There's a big difference between April and Danny, which Louise is the first to note, which is that Danny is very sort of decidedly gay from the beginning. April you get the feeling is more sexually manifold or more sexually ambidextrous. She can sort of move back and forth between the lesbian and the heterosexual worlds.
Actually, I'd like you to read a passage about that in which Louise, the mother, is thinking about both of her children being gay.
As far as Louise could tell, April's homosexuality was more political than anything else, a phase she was going through, having more to do with feminism than desire. She chose to ignore the fact that this phase was now entering its 10th year. Danny was a different matter. With Danny, there didn't seem to be a choice. She had guessed it early on, not so much from conventional symptoms. He didn't dress up in her clothes or play with dolls or anything like that. But from the way he tended to resist certain activities, sports and watching football games and working in the garden with his father, in favor of standing in the kitchen with Louise, just talking to her while she cooked, or sitting in his room, cutting pictures of nature out of magazines and pasting them in a notebook he had already filled with magic marker psychedelia. She smiled to think of these things afterwards. And anyway, at least he was safe now. He wasn't running around the underside of San Francisco. He was living with a responsible man in a neat house in a suburb. He was a lawyer, successful. It could have been worse. He could have been in Alaska, working at a canning factory. He could have been dead.
I think one of the running themes of this book is this comparison between April and Danny, between the lesbian daughter and the homosexual son, and the kind of lives that they lead, and their motivations. Do you share the mother's thought there that April's lesbianism might be more politically than sensually motivated?
Ultimately, people fall anywhere along a very broad spectrum of sexual identity. And April, I think, is clearly not someone who is 100% gay. I mean, she's had a very active heterosexual life and enjoyed it. On the other hand, it seems to me that to choose at some point to become a lesbian is a perfectly valid thing to do. And at the same time, and I think this is perhaps what I understand that Louise, the mother in my book, doesn't understand, to make a political choice and to make an erotic choice may be one and the same thing.
Danny, the main character of your novel, lives in the suburbs with his lover. And his lover, Walter, says he wanted to move to the suburbs to uproot his homosexuality from its natural urban soil and replant it in the pure earth of his green garden.
Mm-hmm.
Want to explain?
Well, Walter is actually, as he says that, realizing that it was sort of a delusion to have the idea that he could do that. His idea is that he wants to lead a domestic homosexual life, which is a perfectly valid thing to want to do. And what he's reflecting on there is the implications of that choice and perhaps the downside of that choice. The downside being that in exchange for the safety and the security of a sort of quiet suburban existence, what he's given up is the kind of sense of adventure and exploration which has long been associated with urban gay life and which is something that he longs for in his own life.
You're two characters, the two men who live in the suburbs, you don't set them in opposition to the community. It's not a question of them, you know, facing a lot of neighbors who are suspicious of two men living together. I mean, they go to gay homeowners meetings at the Unitarian Church. Mm-hmm. There's a gay culture in the suburbs.
They're what would be called by some people in the gay movement assimilationists, but assimilationists of a very new variety in that they have managed to make this assimilation without denying their homosexuality or without pretending anything. You know, they're both openly gay. At the same time, they've chosen to lead what is perceived as a conventionally straight lifestyle, which is sort of contradictory to the kind of stonewall ethos of the late 70s, but it seems to me is a real reflection of the direction in which a lot of gay men are taking their lives now.
The mother of April and Danny in your novel is dying of cancer, and she's had cancer for about 20 years. And I think there are many very moving passages about this in your novel. And I was wondering how you knew so much about what a family experience like that would be.
I should say, first of all, most of this book isn't autobiographical, but I would be really lying in a very criminal way if I said that Louise wasn't my mother and that the story of her death wasn't the story of my mother's death. a funny thing that's been happening is that as I've been doing a lot of interviews with the gay press, many people have asked me if Louise's death was meant to be sort of a metaphor for AIDS,
mm-hmm.
because she dies of a very strange reaction,
mm-hmm.
chemical reaction, which is the result of her being immunocompromised. It's an immune deficiency death. It's one of the bewildering aspects of being a fiction writer when those aspects of your novel, which come very much from your own experience, end up being interpreted as if they were the most artificial kinds of constructions.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of the fiction being written by gay men now has something to do with AIDS. There's
mm-hmm.
frequently a character dying of it or a lover who has died of it. And in your novel, AIDS isn't really... It's kind of in the background,
mm-hmm.
but not mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the person dying of cancer is the mother.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, mothers still die of cancer.
Exactly.
It seems to me there's a kind of tyranny at work, particularly toward gay writers, about the subject of AIDS. One review of this book sort of complained about the fact that the central disease was cancer and not death, as if I wasn't being politically correct. But I think it's very dangerous tyranny because the result of it is to treat AIDS as a sort of monolith and as the only thing which exists in gay men's lives.
As we've discussed, a lot of your stories are about families. But I wonder how your family has reacted to that and if they feel exposed because many of your readers might interpret it as being more autobiographical than it actually is.
It seems to me that my family has reacted with Herculean nobility. I'm always amazed at how well they have handled my books and grateful, constantly grateful. They have been wonderful about it. And while it's true that things I've written have upset them, we've learned to deal with it. I think one of the best things about my family is that no one in my family bears grudges. The way problems get worked out is that you sit down and you yell and scream, you say what you have to say, the other person says what he has to say, you get it out, and then you can go on.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Levitt's new novel, Equal Affections, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, are you covering the latest news on the North trial?
We are. You know, Judge Gerhard Gesell, who's actually hearing the case today, refused an agreement that had been reached by the Justice Department and the special prosecutor. And that means that the appeal the Justice Department has brought will have to be heard by the Supreme Court. In other words, the North trial doesn't get started right away, which seemed possible this morning. Also, we'll be hearing about the settlement between Union Carbide and the government of India on behalf of the Bhopal victims and why some groups say it didn't serve the Bhopal victims at all. And a piece about the man who played Andy on the TV sitcom Amos and Andy, who was actually a filmmaker.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. By far the most controversial book to be released recently is Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses. Muslims around the world have protested the book as insulting to Islam. It's been banned in India, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, and angry crowds have reacted to its release with riots and book-burning rallies. Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini has ordered Muslims to seek out and kill Rushdie and his publishers. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
In case you're still wondering, Salman Rushdie does indeed blaspheme Islam. He also blasphemes Maggie Thatcher's England, and he's not very nice to V.S. Naipaul. The Satanic Verses means to be entirely blasphemous. It's one of those all-or-nothing metafictions, a grand narrative of history, religion, literature, and pop culture, full of Hindu cycles and Muslim dualisms, post-colonial identity crisis and modernist pastiche, Bombay bombast and stiff upper liposuction, Babu baby talk and ad agency jargon, cinema gossip, elephant masks, pop jingles, bad puns, and kinky sex. A sort of Sammy and Rosie Get Laid in Doris Lessing's The Four Gated City, from which the Sly Boots author god tiptoes away with a cannibal grin. Who, me, he says? Although Rushdie's principal characters, Saladin and Gabriel, were both born in Bombay, they are two different kinds of Indian actor. Saladin left home to marry the fair Pamela, co-star in a popular English children's television program called The Aliens Show, and do voiceovers in commercials for everything from ketchup to garlic-flavored crisps. He is a mimic man. Gabriel stayed home to star on the big screen and in various bedrooms. He has played the god parts in low-budget Indian movies known as theologicals. He is an imposter. The mimic man and the imposter fall out of the sky when their plane from Bombay to London is blown up by Sikh terrorists. Landing in Sussex, they've undergone a metamorphosis. Saladin is turned into a goat. Maybe he's really Shaitan, the devil. Anyway, in Thatcher's England, with his horns and tail, he looks like every wog, and they lock him up in a jail for illegal immigrants. Gabriel, on the other hand, acquires a halo. Either he's the Archangel Gabriel, or Azrael, the agent of God's wrath, or he's crazy. Anyway, he has bad dreams, and these dreams are what got Salman Rushdie into trouble in India, Pakistan, South Africa, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, because in them the prophet, called Mahound instead of Mohammed, may speak to the devil instead of to Allah, and his faithful followers like to cohabit in a brothel with prostitutes named for the prophet's wives, and the Koran is fiddled with by the prophet's secretary, quote, a bum from Persia, whose name, surprise, surprise, is Salman. Too much attention's been paid to this part of the satanic verses, and not enough to the parts about race riots in modern England, the hatred of women in history, the triumph of the machinery of images in movies, television, and advertising over ancient myth and classical literature and political science, the displacement and deracination of the modern intelligence in a world of permanent migration and mindless hybridizing, the loss of self and the death of love in a time without roots or decency. We are all an aliens show. I haven't time to describe the many games that Rushdie plays inside this enormous seriousness, nor even to complain that Gabriel isn't as interesting as he ought to be, and we could use a lot more of Saladin's Bombay girlfriend. Verses is messier than Midnight's Children and Shame, the novels in which Rushdie did to India and Pakistan what he's trying here to do to England. But this messiness just happens to be more interesting than all the neat little novels I have to read between Rushdies.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine as a columnist for New York Newsday and as media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with pianist Richard Good about his current undertaking, recording all 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews an anthology of historic performances from Offenbach operettas. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Christabel. It's a new four-part miniseries by Dennis Potter, the creator of The Singing Detective. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Lisa Bruton. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.